What I'm going to talk to you about today is I'm going to continue with what we were discussing last time, which is this particular decay as an introduction of something called the Gym mechanism, which has to do with the quark mass dependence present in this diagram. So I'll talk to you about it in detail here for this decay. And then also, once we're going to have this clear, we're going to talk about meson mixing, which has the same sort of physics with in terms of the mass dependence of the quark fields. And then we'll talk a little bit about flavor and CP violation, how it's related to the structure of these diagrams, just as a symmetry breaking. And this, you can understand what's going on in terms of the actual math and the Feynman diagrams in something called a spurion analysis for flavor breaking, for symmetry breaking. So I'll mention this and discuss this a little bit. And in terms of thinking about CP violation, in terms of understanding the structure of the standard model, the CP violation is all going to be related to what's going on in terms of these indices in the CKM matrix. So if we get through that, and if we discuss all of that, then we'll get to the point of talking about the flavor problem for new physics, which has to do with the fact that these diagrams and the way that flavor breaking, the way the masses come in the Gym mechanism, the way a CP violation works and feeds into these experimental observables is so kind of delicate in the standard model and such small effects. The fact that when we measure these things, that we get our theoretical predictions very close to what we see experimentally with small errors means that if you want to have physics beyond the standard model that breaks these sorts of delicate cancellations and patterns, you get very strong constraints on any sort of physics beyond the standard model that could occur. So that's basically the plan of what to get through. So let me know if this is not clear. We're going to go through a little bit of details in terms of this, just so you can see some of this, how it works out. So for this particular decay, we started to talk about it a little bit last time. So it's just a kaon, so it's a D and an S bar. And it's just decaying to mu plus mu minus. So it's the sort of thing that you would start to think about measuring and studying experimentally once you basically did the sort of tree level decays that they first started to look at in terms of, so a muon and a neutrino. You would start to think about these sort of dileptonic sort of decays. They're very clean experimentally, and we are producing an enormous amount of kaons in the 60s and the 70s. So people started to experimentally measure this decay, and they started to think about it theoretically. So in the case of the standard model, at the time, it wasn't fully clear that the standard model would, come together as it did, but people had a pretty good idea about the standard model in its early days, and they used it to calculate directly what they would get for this diagram, and they found a discrepancy in terms of what they found experimentally. So the way these calculations work, it's kind of, I think, interesting for you to look at how the calculation works, just to see it in detail from the way that people were doing this. There's actually a paper, that's Gaillard and Lee, which is, I think, 74, where they do a good job of this. So if you just take this sort of diagram and you want to calculate this, where you have the external momentum set equal to zero, then the external momentum here for the kaon and also for the leptons that are produced, then you can just do this integral. You can just basically develop this, take the Feynman rules directly, and what would you get? Well, you would get these two CKM factors because we have an internal up quark, and so we have the VUD dagger. VUS. So both of those would be there. And they would just be pulled out. And then we do explicitly the momentum integral. K is the internal momentum here. So you would have the quark fields. These are left-handed, remember? Because, there's a left-handed projector. It's coupling to the W, so you get the left-handed projector. Then you would get just this simple propagator for the quark field. There would be another left-handed projector because there's another W coupled here. Then you get this vertex with VUS. And then on the other end, when you had the Ws and you contract all the indices, so there was G mu nus, right, for the Ws going across in the numerator, contracting this Lorentz index and this Lorentz index and this Lorentz index and this Lorentz index. So I've contracted those here, which is why these have this structure that they have. But then you would get the propagators for the two Ws, right? There would just be two of them there. And I mentioned to you that this is like a little bit subtle if you start to look at the diagram and how all the mass scales work. So I wanted to show you, how this works in detail, because it's actually a bit of an interesting example of this sort of thinking. Now here, I've set these, there should be a K. I changed momentum. And this should be, okay. So I've set the external momentum to zero of the involving the kaon and the muons, but we have the loop momentum that we're still integrating over here. So if you just do the usual tricks that I told you, what do you have here? You have a left-handed projector. You have a left-handed projector, so there's a 1 minus gamma 5. You can move it through, and it'll kill off the mass term. Then you have multiple gamma matrices, which you have to reduce with that formula I told you about in terms of g mu nu and 1 gamma, the like day 2. And similarly here, you have just 3 gamma matrices. But you do this reduction step, you do the Dirac algebra, and at the end of the day, you end up with just these two contracted with left-handed projectors. And then the momentum integral just gives you this, okay? So you basically, when you do the Feynman integration, you get the mass here for the up quark divided by mw squared, combining denominators, okay? We pulled out then this mw factor. So, but this might confuse you a little bit because this is an mw to the fourth, right? I mean, there is an mw here in terms of normalization, but the way it actually works is the following. Okay, so the way it actually works is that, well, just in terms of this momentum integral, if you actually explicitly do this momentum integral, it has a closed form answer, it's quite straightforward, and then you expand it, and you get 1 plus the up squared over the W mass squared, and then there's higher order terms. But the important point coming in with the gym mechanism here is that the leading term is just a 1 that doesn't have any mass dependence. And then it's these correction factors to do with the up quark mass. And if you had another fermion here, then it would have that other fermion's mass. Okay? So what was noticed in terms of trying to explain the experimental discrepancy of people doing these calculations, they would do these calculations roughly, and they knew the rough scale that you would get out of this in terms of the size of the experimental result. It disagreed, and so people were looking for an explanation. And so the explanation that people hit upon, Glashow, Eliopoulos, and Miani, was that if they didn't know about this full matrix, but they were just thinking about this subpart of this matrix, but if they had more than one quark, more than one up quark in the loop, then they knew that they would transform with a matrix of this form that would be unitary. So there'd be relationships between these entries following from the unitarity of the matrix. And if you look at the structure of the CKM matrix in the Wolfenstein parameterization, it makes it very explicit that there's a relative sign with these off-diagonal terms, right? So if you had going through these two and, as an internal up quark and then going through these two as an internal charm quark, and you had this unitary transformation, there's a relative sign that comes in. So if you just look explicitly at what happens here, taking this term, take its dagger, multiply it, take these two and multiply it, there's the relative sign, right? That explicitly comes in. And of course, there's higher order corrections here, but this is important. This is the relative sign. So what they noticed, what they thought about, was that, okay, this thing's disagreeing with experiment, but if we hypothesize that there's another quark and it has this sort of transformation structure in terms of going from weak to mass eigenstates, then there will be two contributions. There'll be this contribution for an internal up quark, and there'll be the exact same contribution, but with a different mass for the internal charm quark, right? So that's why you get this up quark squared minus mc squared, and you get this mw to the fourth, because the leading term cancels, right? Because until you get the different masses, it's just 1 minus 1, so it just is exactly 0. This should be very clear. Okay, so that was kind of a brilliant idea, and it's kind of a basic idea at the end of the day, right? If you have these unitary transformations from weak to mass eigenstates, this turns out to be something that's kind of all over the place in lots of different diagrams. But you can see that the mass dependence is linked to the appearance of multiple entries of the CKM matrix appearing, which is dictated by the flavor-changing effects, only coming from charge currents. Okay, so this is what's known as the gym mechanism. It's a Glashow, Eliopoulos, I can't remember the guy's name, Miani. Okay, and there's this paper, there's a very famous paper they wrote. And It is an important part of the structure of the standard model in terms of understanding flavor changing effects. Okay. So I mentioned to you that it's a bit subtle in terms of EFT and in terms of how to do this, not the way I sketched it out here. Here, we just have the external momentum equal to zero. But if you look at what happens, we still have this like k squared minus mw squared, internal momentum integration over k squared, right? The internal loop momentum. So this isn't really an effective field theory calculation of the form I've been telling you about of expanding from the start, right? That you can take these propagators and you can just expand it out, go to a different theory, and then do the calculation in that theory, and it makes it easier. So I actually was looking into this the last couple days because I was just a bit curious in more detail about how this worked, because it's not really done in the literature this way. People back then didn't quite understand effective field theories in the same way, and if you look at the literature, it's kind of a bit sketchy. But the way it actually works is the following. It's actually kind of interesting. That there's this p squared minus mw squared expansion that you can do at the start, right? And you transition not from, you don't have the standard model anymore, you transition over to a theory where you've gotten rid of the w's explicitly, and there's just these contact operators where the w's are gone, plus a series of higher order terms. Now, if you do that from the start, I mentioned multiple times that there's a significant benefit in terms of basically simplifying the calculation. So how does it work here? So if you do this from the start, you don't do it in like keep the k squared dependence in here, integrate it, and then expand at the end. You have this expansion right away. So you just get 1 over mw squares for these terms. And then you get the CKM factor here and the CKM factor here just for one quark now. We still get this 4 fermion operator structure. Okay, so far so good, straightforward from the start. So you'll notice that in this case, if you do the loop, it's a different loop. There's no W's, right? Because the W's are gone. Nevertheless, this is a loop of internal up quark and the neutrino, which is massless, which you do have to do the integration over. And it's part of this, but it's kind of like if you shrink to a point, you can kind of see what's happening. Okay, but in the case of the EFT, it's actually a different calculation, but it is a calculation that you just did the expansion at the start and it gives you the same answer. You look skeptical. You seeing what I'm showing you? Can you see?
I'm trying to shrink.
Yeah. So that's the thing. So like it's a bit more subtle. Like you actually really transition to a different theory, right? So you basically, before you do the calculation, you go through the W mass at a high scale, you remove it, you transition, you're in a different theory, and then you should be thinking, this is like the subtlety, right? You should be thinking, calculating this theory, which is not quite the same of just looking at this diagram and then, you know, shrinking it after you've written the diagram. That's kind of like this. But then you would get yourself into the questions of, well, the internal momentum has to be integrated over, K takes on different values, the internal momentum, so can I really shrink it to a point? So I don't want to overly confuse you here, but this is the sort of things that made it so that people were confused for many years about this sort of thinking, right? Because if you think of it this way, you know, you can argue against shrinking k squared minus m squared to a point. But you can always do this. This always works. I just wanted to show you that it does work. And you just transition over to this theory to start with, and then you just do this integral, right? And you should get the same answer, and you do. So if you do this integral, you just have 2 fermion propagators that you have to contract. So explicitly, you just have this 4 fermion structure all expanded out, and you do the contractions explicitly between these. And then what you get is an explicit factor here for the propagator of the one fermion, an explicit factor here for the propagator of the other fermion. These 2 momentum factors, we're integrating over k here. The CKM structure is the same, kind of trivially. And then you can kind of see maybe a little bit more cleanly, like one of the benefits of doing these things and expanding at the start is it makes it maybe a little clearer. Usually it makes it clearer what's actually going on. In this case, you can see quite explicitly, if you just look through with the propagators, if you look at how this projector works, that when it hits this term, it actually is vanishing that mass dependence. Just because the left-handed projector becomes P left, P right, and it's equal to 0 explicitly. So this left becomes a right, then it hits this P left. P left times P right is equal to 0. So that kills this. And then you just have explicitly ended up, once you do the spin sums, you have a trace of this form. This gives you, you know, when you have two gamma matrices, a G mu nu, like with the gammas that actually are then going to be contracting the gammas in here and in here. And it gives you something which only has the mass scale of the up quark. There's no W mass now here. Unlike the other calculation, we've explicitly simplified the problem. One of the benefits of doing the expansions at the start is you reduce the number of scales in the momentum integrals. And that's happened here. This mu is just explicitly here. So this then basically scales as four powers of momentum that we're going to integrate over, four powers downstairs. And then we have a k squared piece that we pick in the numerator. So this scales as mass dimension 2, which goes exactly as the only scale in the problem, which is the up quark. So you can kind of see maybe a little more cleanly why you get this up, why you get this mass dependence. You see, in the other case, you have this ratio, and then you have to do the expansion. You know, it's the same thing in the end, but this is the sort of thing that is a simplification that always happens when you do the EFT. So again, the same sort of reasoning is done in this case in terms of these CKM factors and the combination of the CKM factors. And then you get down to a lambda again with the relative sign, because the same reasoning goes through when you have the charm quark as opposed to the up quark here. Okay, so you get again an mu squared minus mc squared and then a CKM factor. Okay, so is that all clear? These are two different calculations and two different theories, but you can see that you can do the expansion at the start. And it gives you this answer. Now, what's nice about this also, as an example, is remember I told you about this diagram, you also have to worry about this, right? You have a Z, and you can also have the W, right? So this also exists. This contribution also exists. It follows from these CKM entries, and it has these mass factors for the quarks also internally, right? But this actually, as it descends from the CKM matrix, and it has also a gym mechanism in terms of the mass dependencies that appear here. At tree level, remember the Z only couples, you know, diagonally. So if you work this out, I'm not going to go through this in detail just because of limited time, but if you work this out, which is also worked out in this Gaillard and Lee paper, it actually exactly cancels the axial contribution for the WW, which is kind of interesting if you actually do the details. I can show you the details if you want. What I mean by that is that at the end of the day, when you're doing this calculation, you have a kaon wave function and vacuum state, which is contracting here, and then you have these free leptons. Okay? So this kaon wave function has to hit this operator form, which has a left-handed projector, and then there's a vacuum. Now remember, we parameterized this with just decays which had the meson decay constant, and then the momentum of the meson. Remember, we defined essentially this. So if we had psi bar gamma rho psi, we said that was equal to the momentum of the meson, and then a parameter, which we would then call like this decay constant. So this decay constant parameter is just coming, it's just the overlap of the wave function here. But there's a left-handed projector here, so there's 1/2 and then 1 minus gamma 5. So there's these two terms. This term exactly cancels against this. So this just gives you an example of how this predictive nature of the standard model in terms of all the flavor breaking effects and all the diagrams, how they all fit together. You have to be very careful. It's kind of subtle in terms of what happens. This one exactly cancels out from the Z, which is a bit interesting. Actually noticed that I was just doing this calculation. I noticed that so I looked into this Gaillard and Lee paper. I was like, well, that's curious. What's going on? And yeah, that's exactly how it works. Okay, anyways, are there any questions on this? Hopefully it's clear how by studying this decay, you get this intuition, you start to see how these mass factors come out coupled to the CKM matrix elements. Yeah.
So why does this cancellation happen, like physically? Like, why does it?
There's nothing really deep behind it, as far as I can tell. It's just exactly that this diagram follows from. So one way you could understand it is that if you take this, the Z and you shrink it down to a point because the Z is even heavier than the W, right? So it's still a four fermion operator where you're then having a W mass. So the differences in the Z, you get a 1 over mz factor. And then the coupling differences in terms of the Z mass versus the W mass are exactly what cancels in terms of the coupling differences of the vertices. And then this flavor change, this is the only source of flavor change. So the CKM factors and then the mass quark factors, the quark mass factors have to all go through the same. It's not entirely obvious, to put it mildly, but it is exactly the case. It's kind of an interesting little fact. Okay, so in this case, we dug out, and people dug out historically that there's this mass dependence. Okay, which is what's now more generally known as the Jim mechanism, when mass dependence like this coupled to CKM factors appears in diagrams. So the next thing to think about is not external states which are clean and leptonic with two leptons or a lepton and a neutrino, but a meson then turning into another meson. All right? I mean, it's the obvious next step in complexity. So this part is the same as what we were just talking about, but here, the difference now is that we're not going to have these nice leptonic external states with a neutrino, which was massless, but which is now a quark as well. So what do we expect to happen in this diagram? We expect the same sort of physics we saw in terms of the mass dependence of how this part worked to go through the same. If you break it down into an effective theory like we did here, I hope this makes it a bit clearer. I mean, all one could do is just calculate directly. But if you think it through, what should you expect? If you break it down as we did, what's the difference, right? Well, the difference, I mean, you're still going to do this sort of thing, breaking it down to points. You're still going to do this sort of diagram. These will be different fermions. But that went through the whole calculation until we took that last step of overlapping with the meson wave function. And there'll be a different mass factor here. This was massless, so that will change. But everything else is going through the same way, right? So you just expect extra mass dependence with extra CKM factors because of this side of the diagram, right? And that's exactly what happens. If you work this out, then you get two different CKM factors summed over for the internal quarks. And this is SD, SD, and then this is summed over I and J. And then these XI, XJ, this is like the initial calculation where you basically are writing down in terms of X1 and X2. So this now has two different factors where XI is a quark mass over MW squared, and XJ is the same sort of thing. Okay. So the important part of this is not the log terms, it's the fact that you get this mass dependence coming in with four powers. And then on top of that, the physics of this is kind of interesting, right? You have this state, which is a flavor eigenstate. And with this diagram, it's turning into this state, which had opposite flavor, right? And one was D S bar, one is you know, S bar D, and one is D bar S. Okay? So as time goes on, if you think about the time evolution of this system, and if you created this sort of bound state, and these sorts of interactions are around, it can time evolve to turn into this state, right? So thinking about that and how these mesons turn into one another is something called meson mixing, right? It doesn't just happen with kaons, it happens with a whole set of bound states, but we're going to study the kaon system in detail, because it tells us a lot about actually CP violation in the standard model. Okay? All right, so we're not going to go through this calculation in detail, but it's very similar, and you can see why it gets these two powers of the masses. Okay, so let's think about these pseudoscalar mesons, okay? So the pseudoscalar mesons, they had spin and parity, so they had spin zero, and they had odd parity, which just means that if you do a transformation of the axes, flip all the axes x, y, z to minus x, minus y, minus e, there's a change in sign for these states. Okay, so that's what the minus is. So spin zero, odd parity. And that's the properties of the states we've been thinking about. So that's things like the pion, the kaon, the eta, and the eta prime. So you can actually organize these things into a diagram that you frequently will see in the literature and some people get very excited about. So you can arrange them by strangeness. Should do it this way. There's three states here. Strange is zero. And then the kaons. Okay, this is strangeness equals minus one. And then the charges are this charge is Q equals zero, and this charge is Q equals one. Okay, so you can just start to think about all these mesonic states, and we're gonna think a lot about the K naught bar. Did I miss my K naught? K naught and K naught bar. They have the same charge, but they have different strangeness, right? Because one is S bar D and one is D bar S. Okay? So K naught, it's a bound state of S bar D, and they're flavor eigenstates. K naught bar is D bar S. Okay? So these are flavor. Eigenstates. But we can also do CP transformations and see how these change under CP, right? When we take the charge conjugation operator and the parity, we can actually see how these eigenstates are related. So under CP, then what we find is that they change into one another. Okay, so just because they're flavor eigenstates doesn't mean they have to be eigenstates under all other symmetry transformations and operators that we can act on. And if we act on it with a CP violating interaction, change the sign of the charges of the field and do this parity transformation in terms of our axes, then we actually get that they're related to one another with a sign flip. Okay? So if you have states like this, if you have two states, and you want to think about how they evolve in time, what we were just looking at here, it's telling you that they're evolving into one another in time. So we can start to think about how these states evolve in time and try and write down the system and its time evolution. So you know how to do that. You just need to figure out the Hamiltonian and use the Schrodinger equation, right? So you have a two-state system. We want to talk about its time evolution, and we're just going to use the Schrodinger equation to do so. So thinking about these as just the states themselves, what we can do is we can just define a Hamiltonian. For the time evolution of this system, we can give it a general mass matrix. Now, if these were the only two states in the universe, if these states could never decay, then we would just have some mass matrix. But these states can decay into other states, like pions, combinations of pions. We talked explicitly about how this had as a decay into mu plus mu minus. And if we're just going to talk about the time evolution of these and only think about k naught and k naught bar, then sometimes some k naught or some k naught bar we have will decay away into some other state. So we have to include that in our time evolution, and that's just the decays that we're introducing here, which we can calculate. There's an example of just calculating one of them, right? Okay, so this is just a parameterization as it stands with a general mass matrix. It can have off-diagonal mass entries. Okay. And M dagger is equal to M. Gamma dagger is equal to gamma. So there would be CP invariance in this system if we also had another condition. So there would be CP invariance. If M12 star is equal to M12, and if gamma12 star was equal to gamma12. But that's not necessarily the case when you have an underlying Lagrangian like the standard model Lagrangian, which has a whole bunch of coupling matrices, which initially started off as complex, right? We're going to link this story back to the CKM sector. And remember that the CKM factors, they started from the Yukawa matrices, which were complex 3x3 matrices. We took the Higgs to its vacuum expectation value. We did some quark rephasing. But at the end of the day, the CKM matrix had four parameters. And you know, so these, as they stand, are elements that you have to worry about when there's a dagger or not, right? There can be a complex number here. And there is a complex number. It's actually in this parameterization in the 3-1-3 entry and 3-1 entry. So if we're going to study the time evolution of these states, and we have this underlying theory which has the CKM matrix, which has that phase, we're going to be studying the CP properties of this theory, okay? All right. So, if we solve the eigensystem for that, put in the Schrodinger equation, solve the eigensystem for those kaons and how they evolve, then we get something which I'm going to suggestively call k long, k short in terms of eigenstates of the system. Now, if we just take this as a small number and set it equal to zero, you can see that it's kind of obvious, right? When we had the CP transformation properties of these kaons, this k naught and k naught bar, there's a sign flip, but it goes to the other state. So you can actually just take, you know, obviously the sum and the difference of those to define an eigenstate system of the theory, and that's all that's happening here. We're just basically taking the sum and the difference to define two different eigenstates related to these flavor eigenstates, just to get the CP properties. These are hopefully going to be CP eigenstates of the theory. So expanding around that as a CP, you know, set of CP eigenstates, you can put in a small parameter, this epsilon, which could violate CP, okay, in general, in the system. And we know that we have some phases around, some complex numbers. So this is just perturbation theory around two CP eigenstates. Okay? So this is what was done historically. And then CP only if are these CP eigenstates. So if this was equal to zero exactly, then you would have this. It gives back the same state with a sign, okay? Now, kaons decay. We talked about an explicit example of how they decay into mu plus, mu minus, but they also decay hadronically. They decay into pions as well and combinations of pions. You just need to have the diagrams with the Ws where you have the external quarks that you then tie up into pion wave functions. And you have, if you have multiple pion production, when you take angular momentum equal to zero for those two pions that you can identify externally experimentally, that you can study the CP properties of this combination of states as well. Okay, so this is just going to give back 2 pions at L equals 0. And you have CP, which you can actually look at for 3 pions. Okay, so it's minus for L equals 0. You can always draw your axes and such to connect these two, which is, gives you an inference as to why this would be with positive sign. And that if you draw an axis between 2 of the pions, the third pion will invert when you do the parity transformation, which gives you an idea of why there's a minus sign here. Okay, but 3 pions and 2 pions can be are distinct CP eigenstates as well. So if CP was a good symmetry of nature and of the standard model completely, then you would expect these CP eigenstates, when they decayed, to only decay into the corresponding CP eigenstates for the pions, right? Some should be forbidden by the symmetry, even in loop corrections. There's all sorts of hadronic physics going on, but if the hadronic physics doesn't violate CP, you expect that to be the case. Okay, so if CP is a good symmetry, then you expect what we call this K long to decay just to pi, pi, pi. And we call this K short to just decay to pi, pi. So long as these are allowed by phase space. Okay? Because you have to look at the masses of the 3 pion state and then these guys. And if it's, you know, it can't decay to this if this sum of this masses is bigger than this mass. So long as it's allowed, the phase space is open, you expect this to happen. Okay? And you expect correspondingly that this would be exactly forbidden. This would not happen. This would be forbidden. By CP if it's a good symmetry. Okay? So we can make these things experimentally. They're called long and shorts for an experimental reason. Essentially, when they started to make kaons, they noticed some lived a long time, some lived a short time. And then they looked at the study of the pion decays. And what they actually found experimentally, it was pretty interesting, rather unexpected, they find these branching ratios. So experiment, study this, and gives the following fact, that the branching ratio of these states that lived for a short period of time for the kaons, and they knew how long they lived, because literally they made them, and then depending on their lifetime, they could just see how long they propagated before they decayed. They could literally just see how long it took. So this is like 100% branching ratio. Okay. But this is not zero. You would expect it to be exactly zero. And the errors are important here. So the errors are small enough that you know this is non-zero. And you still have this 3 pion. Now you would have expected this to be around 100% if we had perfect CP. And if this was phase space open, but also there's a subtlety here in the sense of the masses of 3 pions compared to the K long is such that you don't get 100% branching ratio also just because the phase space suppression. You actually get something which is, you know, suppressed because of phase space. So there's a phase space suppression here. But the important point is that this is not zero. And we know that experimentally it's not zero. And they were quite surprised when they actually discovered this experimentally. But if you think about how we set up the time evolution of the system, what does that mean? It means that CP is not a good symmetry. For nature and for the standard model description. So in the way we've set it up, that means epsilon, that small, that epsilon is not equal to zero. It's small, but it's not zero. Okay. And just for completeness, the way they actually distinguish what's called long and shorts are their decay widths, or the decay lengths. So the lifetimes of these are actually quite distinguished. It's 5.18 times 10 to the minus 8 seconds. This is the long. This is the short. Because it just lives a short period of time compared to this one. Okay? So they studied this in the kaon system. Now, the way we've discussed this and set it up, you can think about other bound states. You can think about a B quark bound state. You can think about a D quark bound state. So having a down or a bottom with, say, an up. And you could do the same sort of analysis on these systems. You have the meson mixing for B mesons and D mesons as well. The same thing goes through. All that it's sensitive to is different combinations of the CKM factors with different quark masses. It's the same diagrams. Okay? All right. So hopefully that's clear. So I want to get back to talking about CP and how we think about it in the standard model, because if epsilon is not zero, fundamentally, that should come about because of this condition being violated. So there should be a complex number around that's independent of how we think about our fields and rephasings of the quark fields. There should be an explicit phase. Now, you know, because we look back in time with the standard model, we know that we're going to end up talking about this phase, right? This complex number is going to be the point. But how do we think about that in the standard model, that these entries are not the same? Okay. All right. So it all comes from, at the end of the day, the Yukawa sector. So we have plus the Hermitian conjugate. Now, have you ever been exposed to something called a spurion analysis? I don't know if you've ever seen this before. Okay. So let me just try and introduce this, because it gives you more intuition as to what's going on in terms of the standard model and the diagrams we've been explicitly looking at. And it's actually a better answer to your question yesterday or 2 days ago, but why is it that the CKM factors are actually breaking flavor symmetry? Okay, so if you have L standard model, and you set explicitly these Yukawas to zero, then you know you have the flavor transformations that everything else in the standard model preserves. So it preserves these SU3 transformations. So there's this giant flavor group, which is actually a U3 to the fifth, which you'll see sometimes talked about as the flavor symmetry groups of the standard model, in the limit that these Yukawas are turned off, right? These ones and also the lepton ones are turned off. This is just the quarks. So if you want to think about this theory around the limit that flavor symmetry is preserved, you can explicitly introduce transformation properties of these Yukawas to restore this flavor symmetry. Right? There are flavor symmetries, SU3 transformations on the quark fields, which have these indices, I and J. if you start to take the very seriously this as a 3 and a 3 bar, then you can introduce this to have exactly the transformation properties under those flavor symmetries that exactly cancels those flavor transformations of the quark fields. That's not in the standard model the way we think of things. In the standard model, this is just a number. It's a complex matrix. The Higgs takes on a VEV, and it breaks flavor symmetry leading to masses. Well, let's think about the case where we actually restore the symmetry explicitly. And if we restore the symmetry explicitly in this way, then whenever we have the symmetry being broken, then we can figure out how the symmetry will be broken as long as we just take an amplitude and we write down all the combinations of the Ys that we need with the right transformation properties to explicitly restore the flavor symmetry in the amplitude. That's what's called a spurion analysis. So what you're really doing is you're thinking of these as like a background field space where you're thinking of them as having transformation properties like fields. So in a spurion analysis to restore the flavor symmetry, we give this transformation property. Okay. And if we look back here, what we're doing when we do this sort of analysis is we're just kind of we're going to start taking very seriously if the flavor index is upstairs or downstairs. Okay. So we'll just do this. Before, I wasn't worrying about if these were upstairs or downstairs. But now, this upstairs or downstairs is going to be whether it's transforming as a 3 or a 3 bar. Okay? And so we're just introducing this notation a little more carefully to basically carry that information. Okay? So you can look at this, and you can say to yourself, well, what can I build up? And then how does it have transformation properties in this quark space? Okay, so this is, so we can build up this one, for example. So we have one internal index contracted, which is the up in this case. And how does this transform? It transforms as essentially the SU3 Q transformation on the left and an SU3 Q transformation on the right. Okay? So we've contracted the internal 3-3 bar for the rotations of the up quarks, and so it just has these external transformations. You do the same thing here, and again, it transforms on the left and the right with these external left-handed quark rotations for the flavor space. So the point is that these are not simultaneously diagonalizable. Okay? So you cannot simultaneously diagonalize this one and this one. There's always a convention in terms of the CKM matrix where we put the CKM matrix and the overlap matrix, how it's defined. But it's always the case, no matter if you chose. So when we chose the doublet and we chose to put the CKM matrix downstairs in front of the down quarks, you could have made the opposite choice and put it in front of the up quarks, right? But it doesn't matter. The key point is those are not simultaneously diagonalizable in the Q left field. So these are not simultaneously diagonalizable matrices. So there's always going to be an off-diagonal once you have masses around that's leading to flavor-violating effects. And this also tells you that when you have flavor-violating effects, you should be thinking about the indices, which are contracting with left-handed Q fields, like the Q left doublets. And you should expect there to be two powers of mass associated with the flavor-violating effects, because it's these structures which are not simultaneously diagonalizable. So what you expect is flavor violation associated with operators like this, with some gamma structure. And you expect these to always have two factors of the quark masses, and then the CKM factors, right? Just because of these transformation properties, right? So. So in the case of the diagram analysis, this is why at the start I was doing that diagram analysis in detail. So you kind of see it comes out of it as the two powers of the quark masses. So yep, you can just do the Feynman diagrams and see it happen that way. But if you actually want to understand why it's actually happening that way, you can understand it from this sort of Sporran analysis. You can always take a diagram or a transition. You can basically say, okay, what are the free quark indices? How do I have to put in Yukawa matrices, which have these transformation properties to restore the flavor symmetry exactly? And then think about the Yukawas and how they give mass factors, and you'll know how the masses will go, and you know how the CKM factors will go, okay? So this is a very powerful technique to figure out what's happening for higher order calculations. Okay. Shoot. Okay, so I'm just gonna get to defining CP, I think. Okay. Now, in the case of the standard model, In the case of the standard model, we can also do CP transformations on quark bilinears and the W fields themselves, right? Okay, in the case of the standard model, we have this transformation property under CP. And we also have W plus goes to minus W minus under CP. So when we have both of these, so long as, so we would have this transformation, right? Under CP. If CP, if, remember we had a CKM matrix, V dagger was equal to V. Right. So if we had this transformation, then we would have CP being a good symmetry of the standard model, right? And that's not true. So explicitly, we can see it explicitly. I mean, it's not obvious when you think of it this way, but you can see explicitly that this daggered, there's a one, and there's also this, the explicit phase. Now notice the explicit phase is appearing with three powers of lambda. Remember lambda was about 0.22. So it's small, but it's definitely going to be a violation of CP in the standard model, which is consistent with what we just were talking about and learning about studying kaons, okay? So what is this hierarchy? If we look at this, well, this is about 0.1, right? So if we look at this, what is the structure of this matrix in terms of small parameters? So if we say, let's let epsilon, very suggestively for the kaon discussion, let's let epsilon be about 10 to the minus 1, then this thing roughly has this structure. Epsilon to the power 1, this is epsilon cubed, epsilon to the power 1, epsilon squared, epsilon squared, epsilon cubed. So the 1, 3, 3, 1 entries are the smallest by far. And we expect the CP violation to be very, very small because we know we're going to have multiple CKM factors. And it's going to go with high powers of this 10 to the minus 1. Okay? So we also have in the standard model, so we also have in the standard model the fact that the CKM matrix had to do with, remember, these transformations between the weak eigenstates and the mass eigenstates. Remember that fundamentally, that's what the CKM matrix was. We had weak eigenstates. And we introduced a bunch of these U's to go to mass eigenstates. And the CKM matrix was an overlap of these two U matrices. So, but this is an eigensystem and this is an eigensystem. It's a complete set of states in both cases. So the CKM matrix is a unitary transformation. It's representing these, it's a combination of two matrices which are themselves unitary. So it should be a unitary transformation between the two complete sets of eigenstates, okay? So the CKM matrix, by construction in the standard model, is unitary. So what does that give in terms of conditions? Well, so there's two different conditions that come out of that. What is this Vj k squared? Kj. And then there's okay. So this is just the ones in the diagonal and then the zeros for the off diagonal from this expression written out with indices. So there's a whole bunch of these relations which have to hold in the standard model. And by studying kaons and B mesons and D mesons and the decays of the kaons, where we get all these different extractions of the CKM factors, we can put that information together consistently and check to see if these relations hold, right? That's what's the flavor tests of the standard model. And there's something called a unitarity triangle, but it's actually a set of the unitarity triangles in the standard model. So what are those? Well, they're essentially the result of these expressions. Okay, and a very famous one is this. Okay, VCD, VCB Now, what's interesting about this one is if you look at how these entries all scale with that little 10 to the minus 1 parameter epsilon I wrote down, they're all the same order. This one's order epsilon cubed. This one's order epsilon cubed. So these entries are all similar in size. And what are these? This is an expression which says three complex numbers basically have to add equal to zero, right? So we can make this kind of clear by dividing through by the absolute value of this one, and we get and if we do that, we have a minus 1 because we took the complex conjugate. Okay. So we can then just plot these. And that's a famous plot that you'll see in the literature of testing the flavor physics of the standard model, where these are just taken as three complex numbers. Now remember, these are related to only four parameters. So you can relate this and you can just think of this as a space defined by those parameters. But what you're testing is that if these things added together equals zero. So there's a sense in that space where there's three vectors that you're adding to see if these actually combine up to equal zero. And there's angles here. And I'm going to stop, and I'll go on next time. And these sides this is just one, this is this one normalization. Okay? And we can study and extract these angles, which are related to the arguments of these complex numbers, by studying different decay modes. So this one is actually studied with B decays, just similar to the kaon system. We study these sorts of decays. J psi and this K short decay of a B allows us to extract this angle. And this actually has to come with B to D, which is actually a bit of a problem, this issues in terms of getting this error down. But by studying these sorts of sets of decays, we get sensitivity to the different CKM matrix elements, and then we test explicitly to see if this triangle closes, combining a whole bunch of different experimental results. You can look that up as the unitarity triangle, and you'll see that it's, as far as we can tell, indeed closing. It's a consistent description. And what's that saying is that there's a consistent result of unitarity being assumed in this construction, in the case of the standard model, from its weak eigenstates to its mass eigenstates. And when you're also getting CP violating effects, it's also a consistent description of all the different CP violating effects we see in different experimental results. Okay? So it all comes from fundamentally the CKM matrix, but how it appears explicitly depends on the external states, so it depends upon, you know, the individual CKM matrix elements, just like these different sides depend upon, this has to do with tops, whereas this has to do with ups. Okay, so we study all these different systems and we combine the information to check this consistently. As far as we can tell, all the CP violation that we see is described by the CKM matrix in a consistent way. That phase is descending into all of the CP violation that we see experimentally. So I'm gonna stop and I wanna go over. I'm almost done, but next time I'll just finish up on this in terms of description and then talk a little bit about the flavor problem of new physics. You can probably see the issue. I mean, I mentioned it last time. So what is the issue? The issue is that you have this consistent description of CP violation, and when you have meson mixing or specific meson decays, you saw that you got this mass associated with specific CKM factors. So we have this very predictive story in the standard model with very small masses, CKM factor combinations, loop factors, in terms of how all of the meson mixing and meson decays happen. But if you had physics beyond the standard model, you could have something else, some other physics, that just induced the same operators, right? So for example, on the one we were thinking about in terms of K naught going to mu plus mu minus, well, what if you just had some physics beyond the standard model induce this operator with some mass squared, right? You could just have that. You'll have some unknown Wilson coefficient, or you can have this in terms of kaon mixing. If this doesn't have the exact same pattern of suppression in the standard model of all the CKM factors with all those small numbers and the masses that are associated with the flavor breaking effects of the loop diagrams, then you would not get such a suppression if you just had a heavy mass scale. Like if this was, say, a TV and this was an order one coefficient, that's ruled out by like four orders of magnitude compared to the standard model prediction for these sorts of decays. And it's just because it's, in the case of the standard model, CP violating effects and flavor transition effects are so small and so consistently small with the CKM description underlying all of that smallness, that if we want there to be TV scale physics effects leading to all sorts of Forfermion operators like this, say explaining the hierarchy problem of the Higgs or other problems of the standard model, we very quickly meet the problem of like, well, why is it so small in kaon mixing? Why is it so small in D, you know, mixing and B mixing? So I'll talk a little bit more about that in detail. But that's what we're getting to, is that this very consistent description with these strong consistency tests of describing multiple data sets fits together so well, there's just not much room for having, you know, arbitrary new physics that you just write down in terms of dimension six operators of this form. It's extremely constrained. It's what's known as the flavor problem. But I'm over, so I'm going to stop there. Are there questions? I'll go into this in more detail next time, finishing up. Clear, unclear? Yeah.
Are we going to talk more about the hierarchy problem later? Or
Later, if you want to, we can talk about that. Yeah, because that's the issue, right? Well, I mean, we can. Yes, we can talk about it. Just in short, the hierarchy problem, for reasons we can discuss in more detail, wants this to be TV scale. Right? It's basically you want something, you want some new physics, which is like 4 pi times the Higgs mass. And I can explain that in more detail to you as to exactly why we want that. It's just basically because loop effects can destabilize the Higgs mass otherwise. Dimensional analysis is basically what's happening. So this is like a factor of 10. And we know this is like 100 GeV, so this gets to about TeV. So we would like that for a nice natural solution to the hierarchy problem. But as soon as you do that, then you start to worry about things like this, right? Because if you put just a TeV here generically for 4 fermion operators, which we test the heck out of, like flavor physics is an enormous program. Tons of things are measured. Tons of things are constrained very, very precisely. Then, you know, you immediately get into a consistency problem, right? You want this for there to be a natural solution to one problem, which is why is the Higgs mass what it is and not much higher? But then by lowering this scale to introduce ideas or just operators which represent a nice solution to that problem, you immediately hit this, and it hits you hard because you're at 4 orders of magnitude out in terms of, you know, consistency. And that's a major problem in the field.